assisted to get this information to all the members who are here today. In particular, we know that Commissioner Campion has been greatly flexible in the meeting with us and in willing to accommodate the members and the chairs in wanting to have this meeting, as well as Jerry from the OJP, who has really took our requests and went out and combed through all the documents and provided us with the necessary information for our discussion today. So, in addition to hearing from the commissioner to give us an update, I think at the end of the last hearing, we had a question hanging about what is the future of the or what are the future options for the Metro Gang Strike Force. We understood at that time that the commissioner was in conversation with the different players involved to try to come back to us with an update on where that conversation is. And so we hope to hear from the commissioner on that. Then we will hear from Ms. Beauvais about the methodologies and the evaluations. And then we will have an opportunity to hear from three task forces from different parts of the state. We understand that they are doing great work in this area, and it's important to have that conversation. And we're in particularly interested in hearing how they're doing their work, but how the nature of their work may or may not have changed post the OLA and the Lugar report, because I think that for members of the legislature, we all have questions about, you know, if this could happen in the Metro Gang Strike Force, then what else may be going on elsewhere? And I think it's important for us to be upfront and transparent, and let's answer that question once and for all. And we've invited some task force members from Dakota County, from St. Cloud, as well as from the West Central Drug Task Force to come and talk to us about their work. That's the agenda for today. I understand that as we've had these ongoing meetings, members, we may all be at different places in this conversation, but I think that we need to be respectful to the people who are here today and the time that we have allotted them to get through our agenda. I will exert the chair's gavel to bring us back to the agenda for a conversation. I know that there may be interest to talk about other topics that we may have already covered or we will be covering in the future. We can certainly raise the question, but I will bring us back to the agenda because I think it is only respectful for us to stay on the agenda. And if there are items that are not or have not been made part of this discussion that members of the joint committees are interested, you are more than welcome to have a conversation with the chairs because we do intend to continue to ask some other questions, and we would be more than willing to incorporate that into future hearings that we may be having. So with that as the opening, I would like to invite Commissioner Campion to come to the table.
Did you get that information about the
Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and representatives and senators. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. It is my understanding, and always has been my understanding, that some of the purposes for these meetings is the fundamental goal of trying to find out what happened at the former Metro Gang Strike Force, what lessons can be learned, and how we can move to the future. These are all important considerations, and we at Public Safety are happy to help in any way and provide perspective on these issues. Our staff at Public Safety has provided numerous documents to many of you, literally hundreds of pages of any different kinds of data and documents, and we'll continue to respond to any requests that we have. It's important for me to say again, and as I said before, that what happened at the Metro Gang Strike Force is appalling. It's disruptive. It perhaps might even be illegal. There really aren't strong enough adjectives to describe some of what went on. Real damage has been done to the credibility of law enforcement and the trust of this, and has bankrupted or at least hurt the trust of the citizens who we are sworn to protect. You have not heard me at all downplay the severity of what happened or make excuses for it. You've heard me specifically acknowledge that there were failings by the Department of Public Safety. Specifically, we could have done a better job of assisting, asserting oversight and attempting to compel changes in procedures and leadership of the task force. Frankly, we probably could have shut off funding a couple of years ago. We didn't do that. In fairness to the other task forces around the state of Minnesota that have existed for a very long period of time, and particularly to the witnesses that are going to come and testify representing other task forces around the state, I need to restate a few key points that may or may not cause some confusion to members. The Metro Gang Strike Force was not a part of the Department of Public Safety. The Strike Force was a statutory creation through the though the statute provided little by way of specific organizational structure. DPS oversaw the state funding for the Metro Strike Force, as it does for two dozen other task forces around the state of Minnesota and several crime victim programs. But the Metro Gang Strike Force was created by a joint powers agreement. Like all task forces statewide, it had an advisory board responsible for its operations and a commander and a fiscal agent chosen by that board. A vitally important point is that DPS, Department of Public Safety, only had jurisdiction over state grant dollars. Any expenditure of forfeiture dollars was the exclusive domain of the Metro Gang Strike Force's governance structure. The last hearing, someone asked I was asked why the existence of the advisory board continued and why they still meet, could the Department of Public Safety shut them down? The answer is that the advisory board, like the Metro Gang Strike Force itself, is an independent legal entity. We at Public Safety have no more legal authority to shut down the advisory board of the Metro Gang Strike Force than I have to disband the authority or to disband the Minneapolis Police Department. It is true that we can suspend grant funding from the advisory board and from the Strike Force itself, which is exactly what we've done some months ago. But we cannot disband the advisory board, nor should we disband the advisory board, since it has extensive responsibilities with respect to settling claims and otherwise cleaning up the mess that was left behind. As a matter of fact, on advice of our legal counsel, I have tried very carefully to avoid stating that I disbanded or terminated the Metro Gang Strike Force. Since the Strike Force is a statutory creation, I do not have, and we don't believe at Public Safety, we have the unilateral authority to do so, and it arguably should exist at this moment. Instead of the technical term for what happened, we at Department of Public Safety defunded the Strike Force at my direction. At the last hearing, I was asked whether I or the Department of Public Safety would be overseeing claims that have been processed and have been put in place to compensate individuals who are subject to wrongful seizures. As I said at the last hearing, the answer is no. The Metro Gang Strike Force had its own insurance and its own governing structure, the advisory board, which is now responsible to remedy this serious problem. If we did accept that responsibility, we would open the state of Minnesota to needless and unnecessary liabilities. And we would probably be back in front of you folks at some point in time to remedy those responsibilities. As all of you know, bad things ended up occurring at the Gang Strike Force. I point out that apart from the Department of Public Safety, there were three distinct layers of oversight that failed to prevent these events. I also want to make clear that the Metro Gang Strike Force failed for some reasons that are unique to it. All state-funded task forces are under the umbrella of a statutory gang and drug oversight council, which is the first layer of oversight. The Strike Force was structured as a joint powers agreement and was governed by an advisory board, which was the second layer. The advisory board selected a task force commander to oversee the day-to-day operations, which is the third and most important layer, and the most directly involved in the actual activities of the Strike Force and its officers. Arguably, the fourth oversight layer is that the individual officers assigned to the Strike Force had the professional duty not to engage in improprieties and illegalities that they are now accused of. The Department of Public Safety's role in all of this was to audit, submitted paperwork to the paperwork of the Strike Force, and to encourage or compel the Strike Force to abide by its own procedures. The strike force failed due to the dysfunction of the advisory board. This dysfunction was caused by rivalries and squabbling among its component member agencies. The weak advisory board resulted in the selection and continued support of an ineffective strike force commander. Lastly, a relatively small handful of assigned officers at the strike force began to engage in behavior that became increasingly egregious as it continued to go unchecked. As I've said all along, I am convinced that the bad behavior that individual officers engaged in never would have been tolerated at their home agencies. I also have said that very likely many of these officers at the strike force itself were clearly unaware of this bad behavior by some of their fellow officers. And I have absolutely no reason to believe that the advisory board were fully aware of what bad things were taking place. To the extent that the Department of Public Safety should have been aware of the severe problems of the strike force, we are joined by the advisory board members who also say they didn't know how bad things were, the Attorney General's office, which assisted in forfeiture proceedings, the home departments of officers assigned to the strike force, and various other levels of oversight. I personally never thought, and any of us ever thought, that it would have gotten as bad as it did. I can tell you this, as I said at the first hearing, the Metro Gang Strike Force repeatedly and persistently and almost combatively resisted our efforts to ensure that it was operating appropriately and effectively. It is not an overstatement to say that we got constant pushback and that this constant resistance was one reason why we, along with other oversight entities, were surprised at the full extent of the problems of the Metro Gang Strike Force. We've also been asked the very reasonable question of how we know that other state task forces are not in this disarray that the Metro Gang Strike Force was. The answer is really very simple. All of the other task forces in the state have been both receptive and grateful for the procedural and management best practices, training, and our overall guidance and assistance. We have operated in a completely transparent way with effective and scrutinizing advisory boards, appointing and managing competent task force commanders. I am very pleased that you will be hearing from some of these other well-run task forces today. Apart from the citizens who were harmed, fallout from this situation is that potentially all task forces and all law enforcement in Minnesota might be tainted by the actions of a few. I want to make unequivocally clear that the overwhelming failure of the strike force was one of oversight and accountability by the Metro Gang Strike Force governance structure, as well as the ethical shortcomings of a comparatively small number of individuals. These conclusions are not merely my own, but are the preeminent undercurrent of the OLA and the Lugar reports, as well as public and media perceptions. I've also been asked for a new plan for some successor entity to the Metro Gang Strike Force. I have such a plan, and as we've said, it is heavily based on addressing what did not work at the Metro Gang Strike Force. This was somewhat tough because, as I've said, a lot of what went wrong in the Metro Gang Strike Force was due to the particular structure and the personalities of the Metro Gang Strike Force. I do not have all the answers, but I do have a framework for a structure that would be heavily dependent on information sharing, be a prosecutorial-led task force environment where major crimes would be the focus rather than gangs and drugs, and there would be close communication with our federal partners at both the U.S. Attorney's Office and our investigative agencies. I have met recently, as Jerry Bevere has, with law enforcement entities in the metropolitan area. I am here to tell you that the RFPs have gone out to Anoka, or are in the mail to Anoka, Washington, and Dakota counties under the umbrella of the structure that we'll talk about shortly. We have had ongoing discussions and meetings with the law enforcement officials in Hennepin and Ramsey County. I believe that we're very close to an understanding that will both meet their needs, satisfy state requirements, serve the local units of law enforcement units of government in a way that is most effective for them, and also will meet the needs of the legislative, of you folks and the legislature. In principle, they are information sharing as a core foundation, a prosecutorial-led task force environment, increased transparency and accountability, Again, these are high-level principles, but the specifics are a little bit more, obviously a little more difficult to discuss in great detail. But I will tell you that the law enforcement folks in Hennepin and Ramsey County have been very receptive. They've been engaged, and they're interested in cooperating with everyone else, including our federal departments partners, to come up with a plan that that meets everyone's needs. Lastly, one issue that was disturbing by both the governor and Department of Public Safety, as well as a number of other people, certainly, and I know was concerned by legislators, was the allegation of bias policing that came out of the Lugar report, or to the extent that that there was bias policing. That coupled, Madam Chair and members, with the primary seatbelt legislation that passed last legislative session, which I thank each and every one of you for that. The discussion of profiling that issue, we are going to announce apparently today that we are going to roll out a program that we have talked about and worked on here for probably a good 6 months, if not longer, and that is to take federal NHTSA money, National Transportation Highway Safety money, that we got as an incentive to pass primary seatbelt, and try to achieve a goal in the state of Minnesota, and that is to have a camera in every uniformed squad car in the state of Minnesota. We have collected up about $2.9 million. We need a little bit more of an okay from our federal partners in Chicago, but we feel confident that we can get that. We think that will buy some close to 500 cameras. We would also be offering a suggestion to the legislature, which I fully anticipate will be in the governor's recommendation for the legislative process, and that is to take some of that forfeited money that comes in every year to the state of Minnesota, a portion of that, to put it in a revolving account well on into the future so that we can keep that technology. First of all, buy cameras that for squad cars that we can't fulfill with the $2.9 million, and then keep a revolving fund that will keep that technology current so that we can keep state-of-the-art technology in uniform squad cars in the state of Minnesota. We don't think that's a panacea. We think it's very sound public policy. We think it addresses many issues, and we think it will be well received. We know it will be well received by law enforcement partners that we've talked to, and again, we think it's good public policy well into the future. With that, Madam Chair, I'll try to answer any questions anybody has.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, thank you for your comments and your efforts and your honesty. I know this is you have one of the more difficult jobs here, trying to put all this back together and, as Chair Moa said, restore public trust in our gang fighting efforts. I just have to say, though, and I have a question for you, a specific question, and you hinted at it in your comments, but you know, I feel like I can hardly wake up in the morning and read the newspaper. It's like every day there's a new revelation and allegations about the gang strike force, and this one in the Pioneer Press was particularly sickening, if it's true. But I just have to say that, you know, there's very few times in my time here that I've been embarrassed to be a legislator, and this is one of them. Because the allegations that came forth in the Lugar report, as well as the OLA report, that's happening in our name. We funded the Minnesota Metro Gang Strike Force, Commissioner, and I'll tell you, I am really struggling with it. And then when I hear your explanation about the advisory board, I'm wondering how the public is supposed to perceive this. I understand you're saying that it's an independent legal entity, is your quote. But at the same time, you called the advisory board dysfunctional, and you talked about the personalities involved. Did you not say that, Commissioner?
Yes,
Commissioner.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative.
Thank
yes.
you. Just you were rolling our eyes. I wanted to make sure that.
I have a head cold, Representative. Okay. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to be clear. You said it was dysfunctional, and you talked about the personalities. And you put part of the blame at the governance structure of the advisory board. But the advisory board, unless it's changed, I mean, it's still the same people. I mean, so if, I mean, I'm just trying the analogy here. If you're operating a business or a nonprofit or what have you, and you have several managers who are in charge of scores of people, and it's your responsibility to make sure that they are functioning according to the rules and the procedures of the operation, and you find out that they're not, I mean, are you not complicit in this? I mean, what, and you find out that, that people are stealing money from your organization, are you in, and you don't say anything or do anything because there's personality conflicts, as you say, that there's this indifference that goes on? I mean, I don't know how we're supposed to have faith in the advisory board that was that has been in operation, and they're hiring attorneys. Who's this Joe Flynn? We have Corey Land, John Iverson I read about. Are we supposed to trust that they're going to get us out of this mess? Is that what you're telling us? That there's no that we're supposed to just hand this over to the very people who were supposed to be accountable and responsible and have oversight over the Metro Gang Strike Force? Maybe there's not another solution here, but I don't think that this is a good one. And I just have to say that to members of these committees. I just it's beyond me that these people are still running the show.
Commissioner, if you would like to answer.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Piemar. They aren't running the show. We took all the money away from them. The only function they have now is to try to remedy some of these complaints and some of these suits through an apparatus that's been created. Representative Piemar, we all who are not lawyers, and even some of us, which I, you know, even some lawyers take advice from other legal authorities. I have been told that we have not the authority to shut down the Metro Gang Strike Force Advisory Board. I understand your frustration. You and I have talked offline about this. I can't dispute or argue with your logic, but we don't have the authority to do that. And second of all, if we did, what I said in my presentation is, if we accepted the liability of that, we would open the state up to needless and unnecessary liability that we will, you or the state will end up paying for.
Madam
That's
Chair,
the advice.
I know you want to move on, so I'm not going to belabor this, but this is unacceptable. I just find this unacceptable that the very people who are responsible for that entity are the ones that you're, who's overseeing them?
Well, Representative Piemar, I think that that's a question for the members of these committees to contemplate. And I'm going to have Mr. Backus come up. Mr. Backus? Mr. Backus is counsel to the Judiciary Committee. I do want that question answered about whether or not the advisory board is an independently statutorily created entity. Because I think what I'm hearing today is that, Representative Piemar, you've raised a thoughtful question, but I don't know that it is, if that is the case, I don't know that it is within the commissioner's purview to respond to them. I think that if we're concerned about the advisory board, we created the advisory board, then we ought to perhaps be having that conversation with the advisory board before these committees.
Madam Chair, I think the only solution appears to be is that each individual city and county would have to pull away from the joint powers agreement, and that would satisfy it. I mean, I don't know how else you do it. If the commissioner is accurate that it's an independent legal entity that was formed in that agreement. But, you know, I'm just talking about the perception to the public and to this individual legislator.
So
maybe
Mr.
legally
Backus,
we're in a bind here. I don't know.
Mr. Backus, could you answer that question for us statutorily? Is this board an independently created board that perhaps maybe we are the ones who have to do something if we're concerned about this board's continual existence?
Madam Chair, members, yes, I don't disagree with what the commissioner said. It's an independent body in statute. It's 299A.641. The membership is specified. I think it would be the type of thing where legislation could amend it or shut it down, certainly, but it is in statute.
And the membership of this board, Mr. Backus, are they appointed by, could you briefly go remind us what the membership is?
Madam Chair, there's a, it's set out in Subdivision 2 of that law. It's the director of the Office of Special Investigations as a representative of the Commissioner of Corrections, the superintendent of the BCA is a representative of the Commissioner of Public Safety, the Attorney General, eight chiefs of police selected by the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, eight sheriffs selected by the Sheriff's Association, the U.S. Attorney from Minnesota, two county attorneys selected by the County Attorneys Association, a command-level representative of the gang strike force, of a gang strike force, a representative from a drug task force, a representative from the U.S. DEA, representative from U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, representative from the FBI, tribal peace officer, and two additional members selected by the Oversight Council. And then there's a, I believe there's a senator and a rep who serve on it as well.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. Any additional questions to Commissioner Campion? Senator Berglund.
Well, first of all, I had a question for Mr. Backus before he leaves.
Mr. Backus will come back to the table.
Madam Chair, maybe
Mr.
I should
Backus?
Clarify that. That I was talking about the Oversight Council on that.
Madam Chair and Mr. Backus, is it possible that the organizations that appoint people to this group can change their representatives?
Mr. Backus?
They could change their appointees?
Yes, they can.
Madam Chair, I don't see why they couldn't.
That's exactly right.
Madam Chair, then I might suggest that that might be a strong suggestion we make to those organizations, since they haven't delivered on the oversight in the past. I do also have a question for Commissioner.
Senator Berglund.
Campion. You said your ideas about restructuring the Metro Gang Strike Force would include having them not be limited to the types of crimes that they've been limited to in the past, but to be involved in major crimes. And I wondered if you could tell us what you mean by major crimes.
Commissioner Campion.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't think I ever said anything about restructuring the Metro Gang Strike Force. That's gone. It'll never be reconstituted. This is a completely different template that we're talking about, a different structure, different command structure with a different mission. To answer your question, what would state your the last
part? Well, you said they would be focusing on major crimes, and I'm trying to understand what you mean by major crimes.
Madam Chair, Commissioner. Senator, a higher level of offender, a career criminal type of offender. We have some federal partners that are going to do some work in that area, so we want to be in concert with them, not in competition with them. But people who cause problems in neighborhoods, people who cause problems in communities, that's I'm not to say that they didn't do that before, but it certainly is a higher level multi-jurisdictional approach to people who are violent offenders, first of all, and repeat offenders that live in communities.
Well, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, you know, drug dealing and gangs are a major problem in the district I represent. It's a major problem with livability in many of the neighborhoods that I serve. And, you know, so I don't think taking our eye off of that ball in favor of something else, and I'm not exactly sure if that's what you said, I'm still not sure, is necessarily what we need to be doing. I believe the problem here was the individuals who are involved in this particular organization and a lack of oversight of the organization, not what the purpose of the organization was.
That's correct.
And if the purpose is going to change in favor of something else, then I certainly would need to understand that a lot better before I would be able to support it.
Madam Chair, Senator, one of the things we're trying to accomplish globally is, again, as I said, setting up a structure and a mission that meets Department of Public Safety and state goals, yet allows local jurisdictions the flexibility to focus their resources where they determine they need to be. Some of these task forces have done very good work in human trafficking cases, in armed robberies, in other things related to identity theft kinds of cases. They're not completely restricted to gangs and drugs alone. that will be probably the biggest share of the activity that they embark on, but they're not limited to that alone. If there's a community in Minneapolis that has other problems, it's nothing to prevent that organization or that task force that exists there, if the chief or the commander so deems it, to focus in on that problem. It's not to eliminate, it's not to forget the gang and drug problem, but the reality is that there are other activities that local law enforcement officials need to emphasize.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Campion, one of the issues that arose out of here was the fact that we're concerned that the task force wasn't taking its mission, and that there were very few gang activities, and there were many sweeps of the field, apparently, to deal with other offenders, but we're not dealing with the individual that's drug or there's others that I can see in the gangs. Would you care to respond to that?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley. Again, we're talking about what took place in the past, the Metro Gang Strike Force, and that's not going to be reconstituted. We are going to try to, again, focus on a model that is more responsive and transparent. Again, a large share of that will be gangs and drugs, but it won't be exclusively gangs and drugs, or at least we shouldn't limit a local chief or sheriff from saying this is all you can do, when in fact they may have problems in a particular area that require the resources. And we want to emphasize a higher level of offender, a multi-jurisdictional offender. That's what the money really is there to create, a multi-jurisdictional, people who cross jurisdictional boundaries and cause problems and are repeat offenders. I mean, it's a vague concept in some sense, but it's a mission that is perhaps at a little higher level than may have been in the past.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, it just seems to me that you're not following the edicts of what the legislature was interested in as far as the gang activities. And I'm not sure that what you're offering as a substitute is appropriate. We didn't authorize that out of this committee or committees. And I'm wondering why you are not sharpening up the gang activities and not go in other directions until you've got legislative authorization.
Senator Foley, I think the charge here to the commissioner is to engage the local law enforcement officials in a conversation that, short of reconstituting what we legislatively authorize, which I think the conclusion has been drawn that the infrastructure of it is not going to be functional. And so the charge here is for the commissioner to engage in conversations with the law enforcement agencies that are part of this multi-jurisdictional effort to come back to the legislature with an option or options that would be workable and that would be responsive to the problems that we see in our local districts. And I believe what the commissioner is doing here today is reporting to us some of the general, broader themes that they've talked about as being part of the consideration moving forward as the option to what the substitute, as you said, might entail or might have. And I think that they're moving in the right direction, although you're not there yet. And the commissioner is just updating us on where they are in the conversation. But we hope, and I think the commissioner understands, that whatever option or direction the locals' law enforcement agencies decide upon as a workable structure, ultimately I think we're going to have an opportunity to see what that looks like and to give some input. And so this is not something that is going to, I don't anticipate that whatever conclusions they draw, whatever options they come up with, is going to be it, and that somehow it will be off on its own. We have to unravel the creature that we created. And I think that we most definitely will have legislative input into whatever new entity that comes out of these conversations. So, you know, today he's just updating us on generally where things are at, but I don't think we're necessarily looking at an end product yet. Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Madam Chair. As you've been talking, Commissioner, I've been thinking about the different the strike force model as opposed to the task force model, and I was an English major, so I'm struggling with the duties and the kind of how it all works. But it seems to me that most of our organizations that are out there currently working throughout the state are more of a task force model, a little broader than the Metro strike force, and can go ahead and do some of the higher level things that you were talking about, bringing the Metro organization in whatever form it's going to become, updating that and bringing that more into that task force model. Am I understanding that concept correctly?
Commissioner Campion?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, definitions aside, task forces or strike forces, yes, I think you are. I don't know there's a firm definition for one or the other. We use them interchangeably sometimes. We call the Metro Gang strike force a strike force and the drug task force is task forces. But they're multi-jurisdictional in nature. They have a mission. They're governance. There's a lot of similarities to them. Metro Gang strike force was different altogether because it was a separate entity, not under the umbrella of a law enforcement agency, but your other observations, I believe, Senator, are accurate.
Okay. Senator Berglund?
Just one last comment in regard to my observation of your comments, Commissioner, and that is that it just seems to me, by definition, gang activity and related drug dealing of gang activity is multi-jurisdictional.
Madam Chair, Senator, you're absolutely right.
So to not be focusing on that somehow, I'm not understanding still.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think we are trying to focus on a multi-jurisdictional aspect of that. I think we have in the past, and we'll continue to do so.
So, Commissioner, one of the elements that's under discussion and why you are meeting with the various local law enforcement agencies that at one point were partners in the former Metro Gang Strike Force is how to move forward to maintain but come up with a structure on how to continue to do multi-jurisdictional work but under a new structure that will give the transparency and accountability that we're missing. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct, and to take into account the recommendations of Mr. Nobles and Mr. Luger also.
Well, Commissioner, thank you for bringing us this update, and we look forward to, as your options evolve and develop, we do look forward to continuing the conversation. Commissioner, if members of these committees have an interest in giving you meaningful input, is there opportunity for that as you move forward in exploring what that alternative might look like?
Madam Chair, ample opportunity.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, when you early on started out with coming out with the cameras in the cars, and what I'd like to have you do is to provide with us as to how many squads are not equipped with that, and just give us some idea as to what's needed. And then also, I'd kind of like to know what kind of effort has been that we arrested so many people that were wearing or were using this cameras. Are they more effective than something else? What kind of arrests have we made in those areas?
Commissioner, can you answer those questions now, or can we have you provide the committee members with that information?
Partially, Madam Chair. We did a survey of the chiefs and sheriffs here about a week ago, and we think there's about 500 cameras needed. That was the response that we got up to now. I don't think it's complete, but It was a statewide survey. The data that you request in terms of arrests, I don't have that. I'll try to get something for you, but nothing is readily available that I'm aware of anyway. But we'll certainly try to find Senator.
Why don't we follow up with you? I think what Senator Foley is looking at is we'll have the cameras in the cars, but what do we do with the data, and how is that helpful to us? I think it's something that you've expressed an interest in looking at, so we'll follow up with you on
Fair
that.
Fair question, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. There will be no further questions. Ms. Beauvais, you're going to walk us through this pile of information that you've sent to us. Thank you for being so thorough, and it's your show.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today, I would like to provide you very brief overviews of the gang and drug task forces supported by OJP, the monitoring and evaluation processes that we employ, and a brief explanation of what is including in the tome, the materials that I provided to you. I know this is a huge amount of data, but we wanted to make sure we fully responded to the questions you have asked us. My colleagues will tell you that I was actually judicious in my final selection because I had another 200 pages or so that I thought might be important to share with you, and I do have those back at the office if you need them. First, let me describe what's contained in the packet that you've been provided. The materials are divided into two sections. Section 1 opens with an index of the materials contained in this section. It consists of general information about the task forces, an explanation of the monitoring and evaluation process, as well as supporting documentation. Section 2 includes data on each individual task force, which includes their task force composition, geographic scope, application summaries, a 2009 budget, a 2007 and 2008 report cards for each of the task forces. OJP currently provides grant funds to 23 gang and drug task forces around the state. These task forces cover 58 counties that contain over 86% of the state's population. Page 3 of Section 1 is a map of the 2009 grantees. It still contains the Metro Gang Strike Force, but it gives you a good picture of where the task forces are around the state. Page 4 is a listing of each of the grantees and their award amounts. In 2009, the task forces were awarded $5.9 million in state funds and about $400,000 in federal burn JAG dollars.
Ms. Beauvais. Ms. Beauvais. Members, because she's going to go through a lot of this information, as we get to a section, if you have a question, why don't you raise your hand and I'll try to call on you so that we're not going back to try to look at a document after she's gone through it. Any questions on these sections so far? Ms. Beauvais, on the list of the amount of monies that are given to the grantees, this is the amount that they get from OJP.
That is correct.
This does not necessarily represent their budget.
That is correct.
Independently operating task forces.
The total cost of the task force operations really, and the ratio of local funds to grant funds really vary widely from task force to task force. Our staff estimate that about 40% of overall state operations are supported through grant funds.
Very good. Please continue. Representative Cornish.
Senator Rowan, just for my understanding here, all this data that we're going through now, is this just historical data to help us understand the task force, or has any of this data been asked to bring together since the hullabaloo started to help us find a solution? Or these report cards we talk about are old report cards, not one that has been done since. So this is mostly historical data just to help us understand. It's not anything we've asked to do since this started.
Ms. Beauvais, is that correct?
Madam Chair, we were asked to provide information as why we thought the other task forces were operating effectively. So we pulled together all their data over the same period of time for your review. So there is no new data. That's correct.
Please continue.
The results of the 2008 task force operations can be found in the 2009 annual report of the Gang and Drug Oversight Council, which you all received in March, but which can also be found on our website if you're interested in looking at the outcomes and outputs of the task force. The task force monitoring and evaluation process is described on pages 1 and 2. Of Section 1, and that's what I'll now describe our monitoring protocol. This protocol grew over the last 3 years and certainly will continue to build into the future, and we're very interested in any feedback you might have for us, how we might improve operations. The evaluation process actually begins with a competitive application. Each task force applicant needs to provide information about their mission, partners, geographic coverage, operations management plan, how they meet the required elements of the task force, which is outlined in the RFP. that give us a threat assessment of the major gang and drug crime issues and trends in their communities. They describe the strategies that they will use to address these threats. They provide a detailed budget. And if they had received a report card in the past, if it's an existing task force applying, they need to tell us how they remedied the deficiencies that were outlined. The applications are then reviewed and scored by an independent external review team. Staff then prepares the review team recommendations. They also compile annual statistical information on each task force. They present all this data to the Gang and Drug Oversight Council for further assessment. Based on this data, the council makes funding recommendations to the Commissioner of Public Safety. A summary of the task force threat assessments, just for your edification, and a sample statistical comparison sheet, which is used in grants determination, can be found on pages 5 to 13 in Section 1. Once the funds are awarded, each task force must comply with all components of the outlined OJP grant manual, which is available online. We provide annual compliance training and also by request. They also submit quarterly financial reports and activity reports. Financial reports serve as the vehicle for reimbursement and provide information to ensure that grantees are spending funds in accordance with their budgets and state and federal guidelines. Their activity reports document actions such as number of investigations, number of search warrants, guns, and drugs seized. The report offers an opportunity to highlight major cases, discuss progress toward their goals, describes any emerging trends they have identified or barriers to the success that they have encountered. Any concerns that arise from the review of these reports are addressed immediately by staff. The quarterly reports for all the task forces are available upon request. I thought about providing them all, but that would have been another 450 pages. The sample reporting forms can be found in this document, though you can see what they report to us on pages 14 to 22. In an effort to standardize best practices in the field and allow for further evaluation of task force efforts, the council, the statewide gang and drug coordinator, and other OJP staff developed and distributed a best practices operation manual in the summer of 2006. It was sent out to all the commanders with a certification form for advisory boards and commanders to sign and return to us. Training on the manual was provided during the summer and fall of 2006. The report card or assessment tool was based on the manual. It was created later in that year. And the operations manual can be found in Section 1 on pages 23 to 56. The report card process and the review form used in the process is on pages 57 to 61. Site visits were then conducted on all the task forces by the statewide coordinator, the law enforcement training and technical assistance coordinator, and our grant managers in 2007. The intent of this initial site visit was to assess how each task force's written policies and procedures and their operational guidelines aligned with the best practices manual. It was designed to be an interview of task force commanders and support staff and a review of their written policies and procedures. Deficiencies were identified in each task force, and resources, training, and technical assistance were offered to address the problem areas. After all the site visits were completed, the coordinator presented a review of the lessons learned from 2007 to the council and to the task force commanders, and it can be found on pages 62 and 63. The statewide coordinator then attended advisory board meetings around the state for all the task forces to specifically address identified deficiencies and progress to date on their stated outcomes. During the last 3 years, a significant amount of in-person and phone technical assistance training has been provided and facilitated by staff, including semi-annual commander's training and administrative and financial best practices training. A CD-ROM of resources was created and provided to the task forces. The task forces who had administrative deficiencies were asked to use the new forms and process provided on the CD-ROM. A list of our 2008 training classes and the CD-ROM index can be found on pages 64 to 70. This report card process, as you know, was repeated in 2008 to ensure that task forces had addressed deficiencies. In March of 2009, all task forces were required to use the RISC-SAFE officer deconfliction system, which is housed at the BCA. Members of all task forces are required to enter planned law enforcement activities into the secure system to ensure that activity does not conflict with the planned activities of other law enforcement agencies. The Watch Center at the BCA monitors the data and alerts affected parties to any potential conflicts. The statewide coordinator also monitors RISC-SAFE activity, and he has advised grantees that compliance with RISC-SAFE will be audited at future site visits. Finally, all the task forces are required to make presentations to the council each year on their outcomes, emerging trends, the impact of their activities on their communities, and plans to improve and expand task force approaches. The 2009 presentations of each task force are available upon your request as well. In response to the recommendations of the special reviews conducted by the OLA and the Luger-Egelhoff report, OJP has sent both reports to all task forces and asked they carefully conduct an internal review of their processes. We've conducted a training session with all task force commanders and the legislative auditor to review and address deficiencies. We've worked with the council to amend the operations and guidelines manual to address issues identified in both reports and establish more specific guidance to the processing and handling of seized assets. We've revised the calendar year 2010 request for proposals to incorporate stronger requirements for task force related to processing and reporting of seizures and forfeitures and advisory board adherence to the guidelines manual. We continue to research the requirements and the processes that all task forces will need to meet for auditing seized, forfeit, and confidential funds. We are confident that the other task forces are operating effectively as they have transparent, honest, and open relationships with staff. They actively participated in this process. The advisory boards and the commanders accepted our authority as your stewards to require accountability measures, and they took great advantage of our training and technical assistance opportunities. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have about the protocol, Madam Chair.
Any questions? So, Ms. Beauvais, let me see if I understand this right. In 2006, OJP developed the Multi-Jurisdictional Task Force Operating Procedures, Guidelines, and Manual, and that, in essence, became sort of the parameters to guide the work of the different task forces. So we're not going to go before that, but since 2006 when the manual was sent out, and I'm looking at here, each task force has to sign a document and return it back to you to say that they've actually received the manual, and that signature also authenticate that they're going to, they consent to following the procedures of manuals, yes?
Madam Chair, that's correct. In addition, in the actual grant agreement we have with each task force, it's also reiterated in that contract.
And Ms. Beauvais, I see here in the sample letter that was presented to us on page 23, it says that adherence to or separation from the best practices set forth in this manual may impact future funding from OJP. So since 2006, with this manual in place, you say that you then conduct a site visit to make sure that, and interviews to make sure that people are actually complying with the guidelines in the manual. Yes?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And then in addition to the site visit, we also then have them do quarterly reports as well as annual reports that are supposed to, again, fall within the guidelines of this manual, right?
Correct.
So since 2006... have we terminated or take action on any task force who didn't follow the guidelines of the manual?
Madam Chair, only the Metro Gang Strike Force.
And Ms. Beauvais, so since 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, in all those 4 years, given these multi-steps that we take, we did not find anything irregular in all these multi-steps with respect to, or did we find, let me say that, did we find anything irregular with respect to the Metro Gang Strike Force and what follow-up steps were taken? And I know some of this was addressed, but please just remind us what they are.
Madam Chair, in the 2006 review of the task force, really the only things that were identified was their lack of a complete files and a tracking system.
I'm sorry, I was distracted.
That's
Could you repeat
right.
that?
And when we followed up in January of 2009, obviously there were significant issues that have been uncovered as of October 2008.
Okay. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Beauvais, excuse me, I might have missed this, but is there a procedure? How do the members of the public with complaints work this system?
Ms. Beauvais.
Madam Chair, members, I think the two opportunities are through the local advisory boards, as well as the Office of Justice Programs does receive significant questions and concerns from the public as well. It is not articulated in this manual, however.
Senator Berglund and then Senator Higgins. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair and Ms. Beauvais, Could you just describe what you mean by a site visit? I've seen other organizations that had site visits that weren't operating as they should, and a site visit can be quite thorough or it can be pretty cursory.
Ms. Beauvais.
Madam Chair, Senator, I did provide the forms that we use to guide the site visits. I will clarify that these are not audits. We do not have audit staff on board. But we do, however, review all their written policies and procedures. They take a day, maybe 2 days. We ensure that we have law enforcement staff available as well as our grants management staff. We review, again, written policies and procedures, maybe do a sampling. We clearly review their grant funds very closely at that time as well. We can do a very specific desk audit of grant funds to ensure that what they billed us for is exactly what they spent the funds on. We do that level. Is that helpful?
Well,
Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair and Ms. Beauvais, I'm still not convinced that a site visit would automatically be able to detect the misuse of funds. Even if the funds were not your own funds, you wouldn't want to be funding an organization that was misusing funds that came from somewhere else.
Ms. Beauvais?
Madam Chair, in terms of the grant funds, we are really quite confident the grant funds have been expended appropriately because of the level of detail that is required in their budgets, and they have to submit reimbursement forms to us on a quarterly basis. We also have a desk audit procedure where we will inadvertently say, you requested reimbursement for these items, and then we ask them to send in the detail that supports what they requested from us. So we have a number of layers of reviewing grant funds that are quite detailed.
But you wouldn't know if there were other funds that were not being appropriately used.
Ms. Beauvais?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair and Ms. Beauvais, I've been looking at the various forms that the task forces are required to fill out, the seizure report form, the activity report form, all of these things. And then I was fascinated by the table on page 13 of section 1 that is a statistical comparison of arrests per FTE, arrests per $1,000 of grant funding. But the Metro Gang Strike Force is not in this table. So after all we've learned in these last few meetings, I'm assuming that the Metro Gang Task Force did not use this collection of forms that you provided, and that turned out to be a part of the problem. Did you by any chance have discussions with the Metro Gang Strike Force about moving to this model where everything was reported and kept track of? Just in looking at these forms, it looks like a lot of what we learned about where their shortcomings could have been avoided by the use of the information that you put together here.
Ms. Beauvais?
Madam Chair, Senator, we did, in fact, meet with them repeatedly to offer them technical assistance as they made the transition from the Minnesota State Strike Force to now the Metro Gang Strike Force. They did not take advantage of any of the technical assistance we offered, and we encountered great resistance to providing the kind of statistical reports that we required.
Darn shame.
Senator Engelbertson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Morvier, could you go by the funding again one more time? The state of Minnesota provides X amount of dollars and matched by how many federal dollars?
Madam Chair, Senator, at this point in time, in 2009, we provided about $5.9 million in state funds to the state gang and drug task forces and about $400,000 in federal funds.
Madam Chair, follow-up. So $400,000 seems to be quite minimal compared to the state. Has that dropped over the years?
Ms. Beauvais.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes. The task force is actually all used to be federally funded. And with the dramatic decrease in the Byrne-JAG funds, they were nearly eliminated. This body approved an appropriation to keep them.
Senator Egbertson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one more question. Over the many years that you've been involved with funding local task forces throughout the state of Minnesota, you're telling me that really the only time that you've ever had any problems or any kind of serious allegations are the ones that we're dealing with now. Is that fair to say, or has there been some? And if there has been, were they resolved in a different fashion? Or, I mean, just it's a lot of years.
Ms. Boisvert.
Madam Chair and Senator, we have had other problems, not nearly to this magnitude, that were resolved in actually through legal means.
Any further questions for Ms. Boisvert? You know, members, I know that this is a lot of information, but we did email this to all of you several days ago in the hope that you will have had an opportunity to look through the materials. And Ms. Boisvert will be here for the rest of the hearing, so as you thumb through them, if you should have any questions, we'd be glad to bring her back up to answer your specific questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will now have, and members, you have in your packet, I believe, the PowerPoints from each of the task forces that have come to share their experiences with us, as well as, I believe, the remarks from each of the members will be of those task forces who will be speaking to us in your packet. I'm not sure in what order they are in, but you do have the information in front of you.
Titled that way.
Why don't we have, I believe we only have, why don't we start with the Dakota County Drug Task Force with Sergeant Lico and Captain Eric Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name's Joe Lico. I'm a sergeant with the Dakota County Drug Task Force. I'm primarily assigned to the Drug Task Force, but I'm assigned to the Dakota County Sheriff's Office.
And I'm Captain Eric Werner, and I'm the chair of the advisory board for the Dakota County Drug Task Force, and I'm with the Burnsville Police Department.
Welcome to the committees. To both of you, Sergeant Lico, would you like to start?
Yes, I have a brief presentation. Approximately 8 minutes or so. As mentioned, we did provide some handouts ahead of time that I will refer to throughout the presentation here, and we'll allow opportunity for questions afterwards if desired. On behalf of the Dakota County Drug Task Force Advisory Board, the officers and their respective departments, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to provide insight into the structure, mission, operations, and success of our task force. The Dakota County Drug Task Force has been in existence since 2001. The task force consists of a specially trained officers from 13 participating law enforcement agencies from two counties and serves a population of approximately 390,000. The Dakota County Drug Task Force operates under a joint powers agreement, which is included in your handouts. That joint powers agreement has been reviewed and approved by the governing bodies of the following cities, entities. Cities of Apple Valley, Burnsville, Eagan, Farmington, Hastings, Invergrove Heights, Lakeville, Mendota Heights, Rosemont, Savage, South St. Paul, West St. Paul, and Dakota County. The mission of the Dakota County Drug Task Force is to reduce the unlawful manufacture, distribution, possession, and use of drugs in and around Dakota County. This mission is accomplished through a multi-agency collaborative effort focusing on zero tolerance enforcement, successful prosecution, and community education. There are currently 13 full-time licensed officers and two part-time licensed officers assigned to the Dakota County Drug Task Force. In addition to the training required of licensed police officers, officers assigned to the Drug Task Force undergo additional training related to drug investigation that is sponsored by various state and federal agencies. Last year, the Dakota County Drug Task Force investigated over 700 cases involving illegal manufacture, distribution, or possession of controlled substances. If you refer to your handouts, you will find that during the course of these investigations, the task force executed 140 search warrants, seized over 221 pounds of marijuana, 8 pounds of cocaine, 19 pounds of methamphetamine, 7 ounces of heroin, and over 150,000 doses of ecstasy. In total, the Dakota County Drug Task Force seized over an estimated $8 million of narcotics, street value in 2008. Task Force operations will also involve locating and the dismantling of clandestine methamphetamine laboratories. In the last 5 years, 52 operating clandestine laboratories were uncovered as a result of task force operations. Task force operations have also resulted in the discovery of large-scale marijuana grow operations capable of manufacturing marijuana with a street value in the millions of dollars. It's also important to note that during the course of its investigations, investigating officers will often discover other criminal activity that is associated with illegal drug activity. Crimes such as forgery, theft, robbery, and burglary committed by illegal drug users are discovered and investigated as a result of our investigations. Other crimes such as child neglect and endangerment, assault, and other personal injury crimes are discovered, as these crimes are often committed while the offender is under the influence of drugs or committed as part of a drug distribution operation. We also see crimes related to hazardous waste that results in clandestine methamphetamine lab operations. During the course of its investigations, the task force works closely with local police departments and sheriff's offices. Task force officers routinely share information and work closely together with other state law enforcement agencies and task forces, as well as with federal law enforcement agencies such as the FBI, DEA, and ATF. These relationships, through information sharing, have led to more efficient and effective investigations of illegal drug activity and other criminal activity. The Dakota County Drug Task Force acknowledges the importance of developing a strong relationship with the community to prevent illegal drug activity through community education and awareness. Since its inception in 2001, the Dakota County Drug Task Force has made over 550 community presentations to over 25,000 participants, designed to increase the overall awareness of the illegal drugs in Dakota County's communities, provide an understanding of the drug task force operations, and a means to report suspicious activities that may be related to illegal drug activity. Examples of these organizations that the presentations have been made to include neighborhood crime watch programs, local rotary clubs, hotel management, apartment management, hospital staff, school faculty, school students and parents, local police departments and county social service and probation divisions. The Dakota County Drug Task Force understands that drug abuse is an addiction and that any effective initiative to combat illegal drug activity must acknowledge this fact. As a result, the task force supports the Dakota County Drug Court. The Dakota County Drug Task Force and the advisory board members have met with the local drug court team to discuss ways to address the problems in our communities. The task force has also become a valuable contributor to the information to this drug court in its evaluation of suitable candidates for drug court. The 2008 budget for the Dakota County Drug Task Force was approximately $1.5 million, and that is including the $1.3 million of in-kind contributions from membering agencies. You'll find that in the handouts that were provided. The majority of the funding for the operation is derived from a grant of $270,000 issued by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. In-kind contributions from participating law enforcement agencies and forfeitures of monies and equipment used to facilitate illegal drug activities or which constitutes proceeds from illegal drug activities. The total amount of distributed forfeiture monies that were returned to the task force in 2008 was approximately $99,000. Each year, the Dakota County Drug Task Force obtains an independent financial audit of its operations and finances by an accounting firm. Once completed, this audit is shared with the governing board and the Office of Justice Programs for review. I will now cover some of the oversight, the task force activity, and the role of the county attorney and prosecutors. The governance of the Dakota County Drug Task Force is outlined in the Joint Powers Agreement, which establishes a governing board to oversee task force operations. The board is made up of a representative from each agency and a representative from the Dakota County Attorney's Office. The board meets on a monthly basis during at which time the previous month activities of the task force are discussed. The board also reviews a financial report submitted by the task force fiscal agent, which at this time is the city of Eagan. The financial report includes the current status of forfeitures, expenditures, operating funds, and current government buy fund balance. In order to plan for future operational, administrative, and resource needs, the board also reviews and discusses potential task force and community needs and trends. The Dakota County Drug Task Force Governing Board established an executive committee. It consists of the board chair, the vice chair, and a financial officer. The executive committee serves as a resource to the task force commander for major operation and personnel decisions requiring immediate decisions or action or board input between monthly meetings. The day-to-day operations of the task force are guided by a policy and procedures manual that has been approved by the governing board. As part of their assigned responsibilities, each assigned officer is required to know and follow this policy and procedure manual. General topics covered by the manual include the chain of command, policy and procedures pertaining to reports, search warrants, government buy fund handling records, forfeiture civil process, and evidence and property inventory. The policy and procedures manual developed and adopted by the governing board complies with the policies and procedure manuals adopted by the State Gang Drug Oversight Committee. The Dakota County Drug Task Force adheres to an officer field training manual, which is used to train newly assigned officers. This ensures that the newly assigned officer knows and understands the current policy procedures as well as the officer's day-to-day responsibilities. The Dakota County Drug Task Force works closely with the Dakota County Attorney's Office. The Dakota County Attorney played a primary role in the drafting of the Joint Powers Agreement as well as the Task Force Policy and Procedure Manuals. Under the Joint Powers Agreement, the Dakota County Attorney is a voting member of the Governing Board and regularly attends all board meetings. The task force officers regularly consult with the Dakota County Attorney's Office during the course of investigations. There are currently two full-time assistant county attorneys assigned to assist task force officers, prosecute criminal cases, and investigate civil forfeitures arising from task force operations. The Dakota County Attorney has also presented multiple training programs specially designed for drug task force officers addressing forfeitures and investigative operations. In light of the reports of the OLA and Mr. Luger's report, upon issuance of those two reports, the Dakota County Drug Task Force quickly convened a small team to make it a proactive approach in comparing its current operations to the recommendations of the reports. The team consisted of the executive committee, agent in charge or commander, the fiscal agent, and a representative of the Dakota County Attorney's Office. The team conducted an extensive review of the current drug task force operations and procedures in records management, seizure of property, handling of evidence, and forfeitures. Our review revealed that the Dakota County Drug Task Force was in compliance with the OLA and Luger report recommendations. This advisory board's immediate response to the OLA and Luger report demonstrates the high levels of commitment and involvement of the advisory board. The advisory board has implemented a strategic planning process as demonstrated in the visioning report document provided in your handouts. The board recognizes the need for effective leadership, oversight, and auditing in all Dakota County Drug Task Force administrative and operational functions. This included planning and implementing support staff and resources, including a full-time administrative assistant and a three-quarter-time property room technician. We're currently in the process of updating the current fully capable evidence system to integrate with the countywide system, allowing greater transparency and additional auditing capabilities. In closing, on behalf of the entire Dakota County Drug Task Force, local police departments, and the Sheriff's Department, I again thank the committee for the time to share information concerning our successful operation. The Dakota County Drug Task Force is most valuable means to keep our and your communities safe from from illegal drug activity. I know that we make a difference in regards to public safety in our community. As you have learned through this brief presentation, we take pride in the services we provide to the community, and we take our responsibilities seriously. I, as a commander of the Dakota County Drug Task Force, I place a lot of expectations and a high accountability on myself, and I expect nothing less from those that work with me and that I directly supervise. Madam Chair, we can then take any questions if you have any at this point.
Thank you, Sergeant. Captain, did you have any prepared comments, or are you just here to answer questions?
I have no comments, Madam Chair, just for questions.
Thank you. Sergeant, I think that a couple of members have some questions for you. I wonder if you could maybe just quickly repeat for us, where do you operate out of? Do you have does the task force have its own independent location, or do you operate out of, you know, a specific office? And then could you just share with us sort of the practical day-to-day when an investigation file opens up? How do you interact with the prosecuting or the Dakota attorneys that are involved?
The task force is housed in a location that's off-site. It's not physically attached to a police department or sheriff's department. A typical day-to-day, I don't know if that answers that question. You want me to elaborate further on that? Obviously, it's
so
in a location that's discreet.
It's housed independently. So is your evidence room also housed in this location, or do you share, where do you house your evidence room?
Our evidence room is housed at our task force office, yes.
And then on a day-to-day basis, how do you incorporate in the participation of the attorneys?
Madam Chair, there's constant conversation. I, being the commander agent in charge of the drug task force, I talk with the county attorney's office, either the criminal side or the civil side, on a daily basis, multiple times. If there are situations where we're trying to develop a case or just starting a case, we'll often refer the officer, the investigator, to talk to the county attorney's office to run it by them, basically to look for suggestions or comments as far as how to best proceed with the investigation to put us and the Dakota County Attorney's Office in the best place.
Very good. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, members, Sergeant, the wheels are already turning in some legislators' minds about some legislation they might want to form here in the coming session to counter act some of the skullduggery that went on here with the Metro Force. What do you think, how is that going to affect you if legislation comes down to start diverting some of those resources somewhere else? Some people might think that there is too big of an incentive, cash or rewards going to the agency, and they might want to cut some of that back. Or some people might think that this is not the exception, that this happens, it could happen at some other places, so they might dream up ways of forming legislation that would affect your seizure or forfeiture and your record-keeping, more burdensome regulations or audits. How will those things affect you? Just be straight up and tell us if that worries you, some of this proposed legislation, if it comes down, or the diversion of funds somewhere else. How will it affect the cop in the street doing these duties?
Sergeant?
Representative, I understand your question. With that said, the forfeiture, that 70% that is returned to the agency, as well as the state grant money, comprises a large chunk of our budget, not including our in-kind contributions from our membering agencies, which is $1.3 million. We'd put a lot more stress on the communities, those departments, to make up that difference, and it would create a hardship.
Follow up?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, you interact with some of the other task forces, I imagine, in meetings and around the state. And naturally, some will not put as much weight on law enforcement testimony as they should because it's coming from the people that were affected. But do you think that if the Metro Gang Strike Force would have operated as you do, under existing regulation rules and audits and checks, if they would have used all the forms, if all of them do it like that, do you think there's enough regulation now on the books to take care of everything, or this probably wouldn't happen, and there's enough safeguards out there now if people would adhere to them and have the right supervision like your supervision has been?
Sergeant?
Madam Chair, I know what we have here, and it's effective, and it goes. It's in compliance with the Office of Justice Programs, their guidelines as far as standing operating procedures. We have a very supportive interactive board. Yes, with all those in place, I don't think those things would have happened. That's speculation from my side.
Well, thank you both for being here and for making the time. Thank you for your wonderful presentation, and I hope that you'll stay till the end in case members have some other follow-up questions.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins wonders if you have other members of your task force here who would like to raise your hand so we know that you're in the room. Are there other members of the Dakota County Drug Task Force in the room?
Thank you.
You know, Captain and Sergeant, I'm only 5 feet tall. You didn't have to bring so many in uniform to protect you. The next group to come up are the St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force. We have Sergeant Joseph Kreinbrink from St. Cloud Police Department. Let's see, Chief Dennis Ballantyne and Sheriff Joel Brott. I only have two at the table.
Yes, those two people you mentioned are sitting in the back behind us here. This is Lieutenant Tom Justin from the St. Cloud Police Department, who's going to sit with me, I guess.
Well, good. Lieutenant, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Senators and Representatives, my name is Joe Kreinbrink. I'm a sergeant with the St. Cloud Police Department, and I took over as the commander of the St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force in January of this year. PowerPoint was hopefully handed out to all of you. We were asked in reference to a presentation we gave to the Oversight Board this fall if we would kind of follow those same guidelines, so I shortened up that PowerPoint, and we'll follow that as we go through this presentation to you. The purpose of this is to provide information to the Senate Judiciary Committee on current status and future operations of the St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force. Our mission statement is as follows. The St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force and the St. Cloud Police Department's Drug Unit will support the uniform section of the operations divisions through quality proactive enforcement investigations of crimes involving gangs and narcotics. And in reference to our organization, our operations, our strike force operates in the investigation division of the St. Cloud Police Department. So as you can see, there's much structure above us and oversight. Organizationally, there's a strike force commander, which is me, and I am over the St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force and the St. Cloud Police Department Drug Unit. The strike force has three St. Cloud Police Department officers and one Sherburne County deputy. The St. Cloud Drug Unit has two officers, and we also have one clerical technician. Our advisory board makeup, our board chair is the Sherburne County attorney. We have, as board members, Sherburne County Sheriff Joel Brott, a St. Cloud Police Department Chief of Police Dennis Ballantyne, and a St. Cloud City attorney. Our areas of responsibility is Sherburne County and the City of St. Cloud. The City of St. Cloud is located in three different counties, Stearns, Benton, and Sherburne, and we also have two different judicial districts that we fall under. Gang members and associates that have been documented in the St. Cloud area by our strike force, we have documented 340 confirmed gang members and 478 associate gang members. This is a total number of gang members our strike force has tracked within the last 5 years using the state policies on purging information. Of those 340 gang members, they represent 78 different gangs. Of those 340, 218 of those confirmed gang members represent 10 different gangs. So there's a large portion of that 340 represents a small number of gangs. In the first pie chart that's shown on this PowerPoint is the makeup of those 10 different gangs. What really jumps out is that 63% of those 10 different gangs are based out of the Chicago area. They are the Gangster Disciples, the Vice Lords, the Black Disciples, and the Black Peastones. And there's also a local youth gang, the Untouchables, that make up 8% of our contacts in St. Cloud. The second pie chart is confirmed gang members by state of origin. When we track these gang members, we ask them where they come from, where they were born. And the unknown part is there. Some of them don't tell us, so we can't tell where they come from. But as you'll notice again, 31% come from the state of Illinois. The third pie chart there, associate gang members by state of origin. There's a similar demographics. Illinois has a fairly large amount, and that's who we deal with. The fourth pie chart there is gang subjects by residency. Confirmed gang members, 47% of the people we have contact with reside in St. Cloud, 10% from the Twin Cities, and 43% from outstate Minnesota or from other states. And the associate gang members shown there in that charter have similar demographics. As explained before, every year we have a review. And in the 2000 review, there were some deficiencies that were shown, and I'll discuss those. And there were some places where we stood out as a strike force. And I will also explain those. I'm not going through the whole report card. I just took out a couple examples. So apparently you guys have all that information. You can look it up and see where we fell in those report cards. Our members were not always adding photographs and documents to the GangNet entries. So now our clerical assistant does all of our GangNet entries, and they make sure that all the documentation is added when those entries are made. When it comes to GangNet entries, that intelligence is vital to our unit and to other gang officers around the state. For 2008, our gang strike force made 1,814 entries, and for outstate officers, there were 2,147 entries made. So it shows that our officers do work on their intelligence information and do the documentation as they're supposed to. Also, we made 63 entries of new persons into GangNet. And for your information, I wasn't able to get any statistical information on the Metro Gang Strike Force to make any comparisons. So that's why they are not compared in here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but can you explain to me how you get entered?
Sergeant? Oh, sorry.
Sergeant?
Madam Chair, Senator. There's a pointer system that the legislature came up with that we use to document gang members. And there's 10 different points that a person, or okay, activities that a person can do that will get them a point in the pointer system. And with 3 points, that person becomes a confirmed gang member. And if you get 1 point or 2 points, then you're an associate. So you can either work them up to being a gang member, but we follow the state, what the state has for us to do.
Thank you. Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay. In the review, one of the shortcomings that we had was our board meeting. Our board was only meeting quarterly, and they were meeting via conference call. The board took steps in January to change that. Well, in September, a ruling came out and said that all of our board meetings have to be open for the open meeting policies. And now all of our board meetings are face-to-face meetings, and they are posting them to meet those open meeting requirements. So we are continually changing, not just from what our report card does, but we continue to change as the laws change. Our units focus on gangs and violent crimes. 73% of our investigations are drug-related. And this is the most common crime committed by gang members. It's the easiest way for them to make money. 28% of our investigations are for crimes such as homicide, robbery, burglary, assaults, and weapons violations. And I will highlight some of those investigations later on in this review. Our strike force also does training for local law enforcement officers. We worked with a Summer Works project this summer for juveniles. We give presentations to schools and to civic organizations. Our strike force accountability. In 2008, the St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force received the Frederick Milton Thrasher Award from the National Gang Crime Research Center while attending their annual gang conference in Chicago. This award was for the recognition of the outstanding work the Strike Force had done in the area of public safety as it relates to gangs from 2005 to 2007.
Sergeant?
Yes.
Was Mr. Thrasher's name really Thrasher? And was he a police officer?
You know, I do not know.
Sorry, please continue.
No, I understand, but at the July 22 commander's training, our strike force was used as a role model for best practices in the areas of seizures, forfeitures, and buy funds. In the first bar graph that's shown there, this shows the investigations and arrests from 2005 to 2008. And you can see that the work for our gang strike forces continued to grow. St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force in 2008 had 180 investigations, and we had 150 arrests. Offense distribution, 73% of those were for controlled substances, again showing that the most common crime committed by gang members is the sale or use of controlled substances. The next two bar graphs, if you guys just want to look at them, they'll show the amount of narcotics seized and purchased by our strike force and our drug unit. Having these two different units under my control or supervision allows me to move cases around. If I've got a gang officer that has a suspect with no gang ties, that gets moved over to a drug officer, and vice versa. If I have a drug officer that has a case involving gang people, that'll get moved to my gang officers. So that allows me to shuffle the work around. Strike force sustainability. The St. Cloud Police Department, the Sherburne County Sheriff's Department provide officers above what the grant funding pays for. Integration into the St. Cloud command structure means that we have the necessary checks and balances needed to keep our strike force operating as it should. The next graph shows the 2008 budget. St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force budget was $582,434. And the grant provided $100,000. This shows that the Sherburne County Sheriff's Department and the St. Cloud Police Department see the strike force as an important part of the area's law enforcement strategies. And then the next graph shows the budget for the combined units of the gang unit and the drug unit, and that was at $806,834,000. Strike force administrative compliance. We have separate gang and drug funds. Each transaction is tracked separately, and we have no floating funds that we give to our officers. We have a monthly audit done by our support services, and then put into place this year is that we will have an annual audit done by an outside agency through the St. Cloud Finance Department. Our overall rating, and that's what the we got just a satisfactory rating for the work that we've done. The concern was that we didn't cooperate enough or communicate enough with the Central Minnesota Drug and Gang Unit, which is located actually in the same building we are located in. When I became the commander, I set up bi-monthly meetings between the two units, made sure the communications were flowing freely. After a while, it was determined just monthly meetings were needed. When our officers go out on cases, they will call persons from the other unit, let them know that we're working an area or a certain person, so we don't work the same people. Case reviews. These case reviews will show that gangs are present and conducting serious crimes in our area, that they're utilizing and recruiting associates in our area, that we provide expertise to local agencies, and that we cooperate effectively with other agencies. The first case I'd like to highlight is a homicide investigation. Just like to let you know that our group was not the only one that worked on this. There was a lot of people that worked on it. This case is a homicide involving two confirmed gang members. One is a confirmed blood, and the other was a confirmed untouchable. The homicide victim was a CI for a gang strike force from 2003 to 2006. One of these gang members was arrested in March of 1997 for second-degree murder. He pled guilty.
Sergeant?
Yes.
A CI is?
Confidential informant. I'm sorry.
Okay. Please continue.
One of the gang members was arrested in March of 1997 for second-degree murder. He pled guilty to that charge and was sentenced to 12 years and 5 months. Just 1 year and 6 months after he got out of prison, he committed his second homicide in St. Cloud. These two gang members have been active in the St. Cloud area, and they both have lengthy criminal histories. At the time of the homicide, neither of these gang members was living in our city. The two gang members approached the victim's residence, confronted him about money owed them. The two gang members used a handgun and shot the victim several times. The victim's two young sons were home at the time of this incident, and they did observe some of the interaction between the victim and the two suspects. One suspect was located several blocks from the scene, fleeing on foot. The second was arrested several hours later after the incident in a small town approximately 30 miles away from St. Cloud. The suspect was getting into a vehicle with other people to flee the state. Through intelligence gathered by our St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force, our unit was able to locate the second suspect before he fled the state. Both of the suspects in this investigation have been charged with second-degree murder and are awaiting trial. Due to the intelligence gathered by our unit and stored by our unit, we were able to locate the second suspect prior to him leaving the state. Many hours were dedicated to this case by the St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force, and this case shows the trends that we continue to see, that a large percentage of gang members our strike force has contact with have origins from different states, and that a large percentage of gang members live outside our city but come here to commit their crimes. Many of these gang members have lived in the St. Cloud Metro area but have moved out of our city due to police pressures. Second case I'd like
Sergeant,
to highlight.
What I would like is you've provided the cases to us.
Yes.
And so, members, I would encourage you to look through the next two scenarios. I think that the idea of providing us with these cases to show the type of work that these officers do on a day-to-day basis, and I think the first case is sufficient for that, and the other cases are there for our information. In the interest of time, I'd like to perhaps have you finish your presentation, and then we'd like to bring up the other team that's here to present. So. Sorry, Sergeant.
Nope. The only thing I had left was a summary that's listed there, and I'll find it. And it says there is significant gang activity in St. Cloud, that we have developed programs to improve our performance, that we have developed programs to sustain the excellent work that we've done, and that we are committed to sustaining the operations of our unit.
Senator Engelbertson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that fine report, Commander. I'm going to piggyback off of what Representative Cornish asked in the previous presenter. With your expertise in dealing in this area and dealing with forfeitures and apparently doing things right over the many years that you've been involved, is there anything at all that you would like the legislature to deal with regards to forfeitures? Do you see any changes there needed? Anything at all that you could help us formulate some future legislation or stop some future legislation that may hinder you? Have you got some opinions on that?
Yes.
Sergeant.
Madam Chair, Senator. Sorry. There are rules in place. And if you've talked to county attorneys and so that do the forfeiture processes for us, you'll find that they are pretty stringent or rigorous at what they do. And there are plenty of, I feel, laws in place. My men and women, when we go out on a call, you know, if they want to forfeit something, they come to me and ask before we forfeit on it. And so there's a process that we use that helps those officers to know what they should be forfeiting and what they shouldn't be forfeiting. And like I said, with guidance from our three county attorneys, in fact, on October 13th coming up here, we've got three county attorneys coming to our office to do some training on forfeitures. So we continue to work on that as a unit, but I don't think that there needs to be any more restrictions put on. It's hard enough to approve and get forfeitures the way it is.
Representative Liebman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Sergeant, thank you for your presentation. And, you know, I have no doubt that you and the people who work for you do good work, and the other group that's testified here today, too. I have no doubt that you do good and important work. But the question that really occurs to me is whether how much of what you do is due to the structure that you're working under. Because, after all, that's the issue we're dealing with here. We're not saying, you know, we don't need these officers doing work like this. We're saying, you know, does this task force structure or strike force structure facilitate and in some way add value to the work? And so I'm interested in this case that you just discussed for us, the homicide investigation, and I haven't read your more detailed report that you gave us, but I wonder if you could just tell me in what way your structure contributed to the result that you got in this case, because I didn't hear that from what you were saying, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, where's the value added here? That's really the question that I have.
Sergeant.
Madam Chair, maybe, and members of the committee, maybe I can address that. Lieutenant Justin, I've overseen the criminal investigation section of the St. Cloud Police Department since 2005. Sergeant Kreinbrink is a newly appointed commander this year, and my job responsibilities were to oversee it the years prior with the other commander. Where the task force or strike force plays an important role is a collaborative effort and the ability to share information among disciplines and agencies. I believe you're aware, as a legislative body, the issue in the state of Minnesota under data practices is the intelligence information and the ability to share it. But it doesn't prevent officers who have jurisdictional responsibilities outside of their own entities from the ability to go out and share information with other officers of different jurisdictions. In other words, the St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force has statewide jurisdiction as far as enforcement efforts go. It's provided through the legislative action that was taken years ago. So the benefit you get with the task force or with a strike force is the joint, I'll word it differently, the ability to simply collaborate in their efforts outside of their individual entities. They are assigned as a unit specifically to target gangs, drugs, and human trafficking within the city of St. Cloud. That is their mission. It isn't to do theft of vehicles. It isn't to do theft from vehicles. They're specific in nature and targeted to those enforcement activities, and where they play an important role is whether the Sherburne County Sheriff's Department, the St. Cloud Police Department, or the metro cities that surround us ask for the help. We provide the collaborative, proactive effort to go out and assist those other entities. The issue that I see that has been to the benefit of Sergeant Kreinbrink is the accountability that comes with supervising. The task force, because of the structure that is put in place, they are accountable to the sheriff of Sherburne County and to the chief of police in the city of St. Cloud, but they are not an independent entity. In other words, by its own nature, they are part of the criminal investigative unit of the city of St. Cloud Police Department. So that has more than just the gang and drug unit involved in it. So it's kind of initially probably a forced collaborative effort to put the groups together, so they'll work for the greater cause, for the betterment of the people they serve. Did that answer your question?
Representative Liebman?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And well, it answers it partially. I mean, I understand that what the goal is of having this kind of structure, but you're giving us here a case study. And so I'm asking you, you know, rather than, you know, any police department in the state that we might go to could give us a bunch of case studies about how they solved a crime. Mm-hmm. And so I guess what I'm asking you is where in this case study do you what can you point to here that you did because you have this structure that you could not have done without this structure? Where is the ability to, where is the collaboration in this case that you're giving us to try to show us how well you're doing? That's what I'm interested in.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I guess what I would point out is what it didn't do is the investigation in this case did not tie up specific St. Cloud Police Department criminal investigators to work on it. It allowed for that joint task force or the St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force officers who were put in place to be a task force to work on the case. So it's not, it maybe is a different way of picturing what maybe a different way for me to say it is that what it did is freed up additional resource time within the St. Cloud Police Department to work on those other crimes of importance while this unit could focus on that homicide. It was gang-related. Does that answer the question?
I believe that if we had allowed the two witnesses to go to the other cases, Representative Liebling, I think the home invasion robbery case specifically addresses your question by identifying how many other agencies on page 3 they worked with in order to resolve that. And perhaps that once the homicide case may not have been the case to showcase, I think, what the multi-agency jurisdiction was helpful with. One more question. Representative Haas, do you still have a question?
No, but I do have a comment. Thank you. As the past park director for the city of St. Cloud, we have quite an integral relationship between where the crimes are committed and how dangerous they get. Often at this table and many of the other areas around the state, people don't recognize how the danger in our state or in all metro areas. Take the statistics of 340 gang members, if you take the statistic of 78 different gangs, if you take the statistic of 10 major gangs that anybody in the gang business can name, you know that we can become a very dangerous spot very quickly. Our gangsters are trained in Chicago and work their way to the St. Cloud area. We live in a pretty transparent area in outstate. People report stuff to Mr. Severson. They report stuff to me. They report stuff to Mr. Hush. And I would venture, without talking to them, they have not reported a complaint about your organization, but only compliments. And I salute you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for making the time to be here. So a show of hands from the back. How many members from the strike force accompany these two gentlemen? Just
our board members.
Just the board members.
The rest are all working yet.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks to the four of you for making the time to come.
Thank you for your time and
thank
the honor.
You. To come
down. We now will have Deputy Umloff and Sheriff Wolberson from the West Central Drug Task Force. Come and join us. I must say that when we were putting this hearing together, we did solicit input from, at least Senator Higgins and I solicited input from our two Republican leads on our committees. And your being in the hot seat is directly the result of Senator Ingebrigtsen. So I just...
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I may, I've been waiting for this for a long time.
Well, I did wonder if there was an ulterior motive.
I worked with these two gentlemen for quite a few years.
Behind the recommendation. But thank you so much for being here. Please
thank
proceed.
Thank you for having us, Madam Chair. I'm Sheriff Troy Wolberson, Douglas County.
I'm Deputy Scott Umloff with Douglas County. I'm also assigned as the commander of the West Central Minnesota Narcotics Task Force. To start out with, our task force was formed in 1988. It consists currently of 8 counties within West Central Minnesota. It also consists of 9 active city members that also participate as part of our board. We have a total of 17. We also have a Douglas County attorney that also represents as a board member, but is not a voting board member with our organization. The primary mission of the West Central Minnesota Narcotics Task Force is to disrupt the distribution, the sale, the possession, use, and manufacture of narcotics throughout our task force. We have a very large task force in size-wise. It consists of over 8,000 square miles. In that, we have currently seven full-time investigators that are assigned full-time to our task force. We have one agent in Clay County, 2 in Becker County, 1 in Otter Tail, myself in Douglas County, and then Fergus Falls and Detroit Lakes also provide task force personnel. We have one administrative assistant that assists us with records keeping and such. Our main office is housed out of Alexandria. We are not co-located. A lot of agencies are co-located, but because of our size, we'd be ineffective as a task force to be co-located. In order to effectively work together as a group like that, we have to use modern technology, which is email, cell telephones, cellular telephones, and such. We also have a computer database, which was created 2004 and went into effect in 2005. With that database, everyone has access to our case files. Every agent, I should say, has access to our case files, and we work a records management in that form. The primary goal of our task force is, of course, narcotics. We do not have a gang agent assigned to us. Primarily in our task force area, the only place that we have gang activity cover for a full-time officer is in the Moorhead area. Clay County is something that we share with Red River Valley Task Force, and they do have one gang investigator assigned to that area. However, our goal is basically narcotics within our area. Just a little overview. I did provide everyone with a PowerPoint, and I think it has some statistical stuff in it that you may want to look through. Just to start with, we did have 190 active investigations last year. The majority of those were, of course, drug-related. We arrested 127 persons in those investigations, and some may be a result of arrests that occurred in 2009 that do not show up on our 2008 statistical data. Primarily, a drug of choice in our area has been methamphetamine, although we've seen a very large increase in cocaine in our area, partly because of the availability and partly because of the price. It can be purchased at half the price of meth. Another increase that we've seen is prescription drugs. Prescription drugs has become a very big problem for members of our task force, and it's a hard case to investigate. And then, of course, the other drugs that we come across, that's kind of our drug of choice. To go into our records keeping a little more, again, each case and these statistics are provided to the state through the WIGO system, which they described earlier. We submit those records. Our budget is from that grant monies that we use. We also have match money that we provide. We also have forfeiture monies that we receive. But what we report is basically the grant monies to the state. We also report the forfeitures as we get them. We do have a forfeiture policy in place. Our policy is that if we seize money, our currency, a currency form is filled out by each agent. It is also witnessed by a second agent or even a third agent. That money is then placed in a sealed evidence bag and given to our secretary, who provides a receipt for that money. That money is then placed in a interest-bearing account within Douglas County, who is our fiscal agent. Douglas County handles all of our monies that we receive, grant money, forfeiture money, or forfeiture money. This information is, again, the grant money is reported to the state. It's also reported to our advisory board, along with our budget, which we review at each board meeting. Would you like more information on statistics, or what more could I give you?
I think that your information here is really helpful. So let's see if members have specific questions. Sheriff, did you have any prepared comments that you'd like to make before we go to questions?
I guess I didn't have any formal comments in mind, but I will have to say that our task force has operated for over 20 years, has been very successful, and we have had very few issues, nothing of any serious nature, and it's always been handled by the sheriff or chief when there has been an issue. And so, I would encourage this committee to continue to allow the task forces to operate the way they have been, because not all task forces have the issues that have existed with, especially the gang strike force.
Questions, members? Senator Engelbretson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
And there was some discussion in our last meetings, and unfortunately you weren't here, obviously, for those issues and concerns, nor the two senators who had them were Latz and Olson. I wish they were here to hear how you actually handle forfeitures through your prosecutors, and should there be a case where a significant amount of dollars are forfeited or at least confiscated with intention of forfeiture, and there is not enough evidence, obviously, to move forward. What happens to that money then, and what triggers that mechanism? What happens to that?
What triggers the forfeiture?
What triggers? What happens if the county attorney says, and I'm assuming the county attorney reviews your reports for all forfeitures? You may have not even had any of these type of cases where you've confiscated dollars. But if there were a case where you took dollars and there was no case, what would happen?
Commander Umloff?
Thank you. If there was no case at that point, all of our forfeiture monies that we take goes into an interest-bearing account. If it's found that we do not charge an individual, or if for some reason the courts would order that this money be returned, we do return that money, and we return it with interest. That is the reason for the interest-bearing account.
Senator Foley, any questions?
Answered that thing.
I just wondered if maybe you can share with us, do you guys ever practice saturation details?
Madam Senator, we do not.
Any other questions?
Just a comment. Just a comment in general, if I could. Not so much a question, but you know, it's been very obvious today that there are task forces out there in rural Minnesota. And again, I thank the chair for allowing me to bring up the suggestion of having those come forward and give these reports. And it's very obvious that there are some task forces, the majority of them, in fact, are working and have been working for some time. And I think that has a lot to do with the report issued by the commissioner. Dated July 1, where in Minnesota we're actually seeing a decrease in crime, in major crime. And I think that has an awful lot to do with that. I think each one of these very professional practitioners here with the uniform and badge will tell you that without these task forces, you probably wouldn't see that 4% reduction in crime. These people are dealing with some serious things, as the representative from St. Cloud was so eloquent in talking about, and I certainly thank their efforts, and we have a very large group of professionals in the state to be proud of, and thanks.
Well, thank you all. Thank you both for being here, and if there are no more questions or comments from the members, I think that we are adjourned. Good.
Jesus, tangled up in my wires.
It's all your fault.
We'll find out.